KPFK Pacifica Radio. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. If one pictures the white nationalist movement that President Donald Trump has wooed and relied on, one immediately imagines gun-toting white men. But white women are also part of the movement in ways that may not be obvious to the rest of America. In a new book called Sisters in Hate, author Sayward Darby profiles three white women who embraced white supremacy. Sayward Darby is an editor-in-chief of the Atavist magazine. She previously served as a deputy editor of foreign policy and the online editor and assistant managing editor of The New Republic. She's written for The Atlantic, The Washington Post, Elle, and Vanity Fair. Her book's full title is Sisters in Hate, American Women on the Front Lines of White Nationalism. Welcome to the program, Sayward.
Thank you, Sonali. I'm really happy to be here.
Why did you want to explore the role that women play in the white nationalist movement that has become so mainstream since 2016? As I mentioned, we generally see that it's men who dominate these movements.
Definitely. And I think that it was actually the absence of women in the coverage of the movement in 2016 that piqued my interest to begin with. Whether we're talking about, the way that the so-called alt-right was covered in the lead up to the election or in the immediate aftermath when they were crowing about victory, a lot of the media coverage referred to the movement as a, bastion of angry white men, which isn't to say that it's not that, but it struck me as likely wrong that women were not involved and probably involved in a very important way. That was combined with the fact that at the time, exit polls showed that more than half of white women had voted for Trump, which ultimately it turned out to be more of a plurality. But still, it just seemed to me that there was something missing in the conversation about the far right. And so I went looking for women. They were not difficult to find. They were there on the internet. And what I also found, and this is drawing on the work of a lot of really wonderful historians and sociologists, particularly feminist ones, that women had been very deeply involved in various iterations of the far right going back over time, but are often written out of that history and underappreciated in terms of the roles that they play and the harm that they do.
Right. We had actually interviewed an author, I think, within the past year or a couple of years, who talked about the women of the KKK, usually forgotten element of that hate group. And of course, when we look at the Trump administration today, which is basically the top leaders of the white nationalist movement that have made it into government, we see plenty of women defending Trump, even just setting aside his family members. You have the Kellyanne Conways and the Kayleigh McEnany's and many white women who have become the face of the Trump administration. So, but you explored the grassroots. Tell me about, there were three women that you profiled, very different seeming women. Let's start with Karina Olson, who is a very interesting case, who seemed to have gotten radicalized in the years after the September 11th attacks, and somewhat as a result of her brother's death. She's an embalmer?
Yes, she is an embalmer by trade, and has been and was before she even got involved in this movement. And Karina's story, I think, is a really important encapsulation of the fact that the reasons people get involved in organized racism and the hate movement are not necessarily because they have such a deep-seated disdain for people that do not look like them. Oftentimes, they arrive on the doorstep of the movement with racist feelings and impulses, whether overt or not, that really don't look or sound so different from those shared or expressed by, mainstream white Americans, frankly. But what pushes them into more radical territory and into the grassroots of hate, as you described it, are deeply personal and individualized factors. So they're people who are seeking something, meaning, camaraderie, power, a sense of a narrative about the world and their place in it. And in Karina's case, she was someone who had always been attracted to extremes. That's actually why she got involved in embalming. I mean, she was good at it, and it's a trade that, you know, pays the bills. But she also saw it as kind of this dark, weird thing that people didn't understand, and she wanted to understand it. And then with regard to her brother's death, you know, she was devastated by his death. He drowned when he was 20. And so there was that. But then on top of that, she was really seeking to understand the kind of person that he was. And she knew that he was into punk music and hung out with guys in leather jackets and, you know, studded wristbands and boots and things like that. And so she looked up what are skinheads on the internet, and that led her into, you know, the racist answer to that question. And she found people there who liked her and wanted to share their way of thinking about the world with her. And as a person who had struggled for, you know, community and a sense of meaning in her life, that was attractive. And so it's in some ways like a more alarming story to me, at least, because of the very familiar reasons that, you know, we all suffer loss. We all suffer, you know, at different times from a sense of seeking purpose. And for some people, that can be enough to push them into, you know, a hate movement.
So she ended up finding her through exploring what her brother had been involved in, I suppose, going down an internet rabbit hole of hate. And there are these dark corners of the internet that attract people who are looking for answers or whatever. So was it that sort of thing, these hate groups online, that ended up radicalizing her?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I should clarify, just for her brother's sake, that years later, she discovered that he was more of an anarchist skinhead, and so was not actually in any way involved with the far right. And so, but that was not something she discovered, I think, perhaps even after she ultimately de-radicalized and was no longer in the hate movement. But yes, you know, she found Stormfront, which is the oldest internet forum for conversations about hate. It's been around since the mid-90s. And it's very 101 in comparison to Twitter, YouTube, things like that. But it's still, you know, a very robust space. And she radicalized in 2008, 2009. And at the time, Stormfront, in the wake of Obama's election, actually saw a surge in users. About 100,000 people, I believe, signed up in the year after Obama became president. And so, you know, within that community, she found people who were, you know, peddling different ideas about race, about politics. And if she echoed them back, those ideas back, they, you know, were supportive of that and told her that she was great and so important. And you know, that was enough.
She found a sense of community.
Right, exactly, exactly. And ultimately that did extend offline, and she did become involved in groups in the real world, but the internet was absolutely crucial to her radicalization.
What happened to her? How did she turn out?
Yeah, so she has a very interesting story. She went really deep, frankly, into the organization. She was involved in a couple of different organized groups. So the National Socialist Movement, which is exactly what it sounds like, something called Pioneer Little Europe, PLE, which was an effort to establish sort of white power enclaves around the country. So the idea was, you know, kind of take over neighborhoods and have like-minded people living around you. She was involved in a pocket of that in Montana, and then also something called the Northwest Front, which was run by a longtime neo-Nazi named Harold Covington. And she, sort of in a whirlwind way over a few years, you know, passed through those groups and in some cases was quite powerful and influential in those groups, and then ultimately decided she didn't want to be a part of the hate movement anymore. But much like radicalization is very individualized and frankly selfish, it's all about, you know, the individual, you know, what do I need, what am I seeking, getting out of it is similar. And so in her case, she felt like the things that she had been getting out of organized hate, so again, camaraderie, a sense of meaning, those were diminishing. She'd kind of had falling outs with people. She didn't like the way that they talked about her as a woman. She didn't like the way they talked about her daughters. I should have added that she was a divorced mother of two at the time. And then she also told me that, you know, she decided she really couldn't stomach violence, which it's funny, you know, people tell stories about themselves. You're able to look back and maybe describe yourself as virtuous in a way that it seems odd that, you know, you were not thinking about violence for all that time and then decided, you know, you couldn't abide it. But regardless, she did de-radicalize. She left the movement. She actually was an FBI informant for a little while, reporting on the Northwest Front. And then she was pretty quiet for a while on the internet after that. And then I found her through the Southern Poverty Law Center, which had done an interview with her about leaving the movement. And by the time we met in person, she had actually become Muslim.
She had converted to Islam. Amazing.
Correct. Yes. Yes. And I think that, you know, the reasons are not dissimilar. It's a community. It's a, you know, a way of seeing the world. It's a place where you find purpose. Of course, it is not it is not the hate movement. It is something, you know, sustainable. And I spent time with her at the mosque where she worships, and I was struck by, you know, that it seemed like a place where she was really seeking to belong and felt like she belonged.
She explain, looking back on those times when she got radicalized, even though she found a sense of community in the nationalist movement and then left it because she realized she was losing that sense of community, did the politics of the movement and her role in it, is it something she reflects on today?
Absolutely. And I think that one thing that's important to think about is, again, that, you know, it's not that she had such a robust, complex idea about the beliefs in the movement. She was parroting things. And I think a lot of people who get involved in this space are doing that. They're parroting what they hear online. They're you know, repeating things because when they do, they get lots of likes and people telling them they're great. But what they're saying is not so different from, again, a more like mainstream way of thinking and talking about race. It's maybe augmented, amplified, but it's not so radically different. You know, maybe they're using the slurs instead of saying things like bad neighborhoods, but
So there's like euphemisms and then there's just straight talk. And so
absolutely, absolutely. Right. And so I guess that's a roundabout way of saying that, you know, when she reflects on that time, at least in speaking to her, you know, she certainly realizes how abhorrent it was to be involved and to say and do the things that she did. But I also think that she sees familiarity between, for instance, that world that she was involved in and, you know, conservatism as we've seen it really transform in the last couple of years.
The other two women that you profile are quite different. Let's talk about Ayla Stewart, whose Twitter account, I think this is the person that you've also profiled, says, a former public figure, mom and artist, most censored Christian mom in America, fake news target and stalking survivor.
Yes. Wow. Yes. So Ayla used to be what she considered a very radical feminist. She was very into, you know, herbal medicine, and she was pro-immigration, and she was anti-death penalty, and studied midwifery, and was I think got a master's degree in something called women's spirituality from a college in California. And then ultimately soured on that side of things, soured on that way of being in the world. She had wanted to have a lot of children, and in her telling, she felt like there were a lot of feminists who judged her for that. In speaking to people who knew her before she radicalized, there's also a sense that she was just someone who really wanted to stand out and have a platform and be admired and a role model, particularly to other women, and she felt like she wasn't getting that. And she started to move into a more conservative way of being in the world, and ultimately, you know, fully into white nationalism. And in that space, she calls herself wife with a purpose. A lot of her content is about motherhood, about femininity, and about how those things should be put to use in the service of, you know, advancing the interests of the white race.
Wow. So she seems to embody that aspect of the white nationalist movement that wants to return to old-fashioned patriarchy. I'm thinking of, I believe it was her name is Abby Johnson, the speaker at the Republican National Convention, who you know, as an anti-abortion activist, but who just a few months earlier had talked about how voting rights should be limited to one vote per family, per household, and that it should be the father or the husband who decides if there is a disagreement, who decides who the vote goes to. This old-fashioned, very anti-feminist, traditional patriarchal, you know, male-centered ideology.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. And actually, Ayla at one point on a blog of hers talked about reading Abby Johnson's book years ago, not recently, years ago. But I think that's a nice reminder of the ways that, you know, more fringe ideas are, you know, finding their way into the mainstream, like the Republican National Convention. But yes, you know, she refers to herself as a trad wife, which is a phenomenon really made for the digital age, where you can hashtag it, and it's, you know, women who are interested in, well, a couple of different ways of thinking about the past. Some of them have this kind of Rockwellian idea of what it means to be a wife and a mother. Some of them have a more kind of pioneer approach, where it's, you know, back to the land, back to nature, back to fundamentals. And I think she's a little bit, Ayla is a little bit of both. But, you know, when you ask these women, and I did ask these women, you know, what about the sexism? What about the misogyny? They just don't agree that that's what's happening. They think that the patriarchy is good and right and natural. It's the way that, you know, nature intends for the two sexes to relate to each other. And that for women to be more like men, quote unquote, is to deny the power of the female body, the female spirit, you know, what it means to be a mother and a partner. And it's a lot of mental gymnastics, frankly, but that's very much the line that they push. And I think that there are women who, you know, in internet communities pertaining to mothering, pertaining to, you know, any number of things, they can find some of that language and some of those ideas very appealing.
What's really interesting is some of these women who seem to be longing for an older era are extremely active on social media using the tools of the digital age to promote this backward ideology. Let's talk about, speaking of online figures, the third woman in the group of three that you profiled, I'm not sure if I'm saying her name correctly, Lana Lochteff.
It's Lana.
Lana Lochteff. So she is someone who a little bit more empowered, I think, of herself in the white nationalist movement. She's seems to be a social media influencer.
Mm-hmm, very much so. I mean, you know, I think Ayla was, she's not so much on social media in part because she was deplatformed in a lot of places, but also because she's decided to take a break from public life, whatever that means. But Lana is both an influencer and she's a little bit of a mogul, frankly. She and her husband run a platform called Red Ice that is InfoWars, but even farther to the right.
Wow.
So it's a place where it's a lot of conspiracy theory promotion, and it existed. They actually ran it before they became white nationalists. And around 2013, 2014, they really started shifting hard in that direction, which was, I think, for people who kind of already existed in that conspiratorial space online, surprising, because that tends to be a bit more of like a, well, it can be more of like a left-leaning type environment. You know, I could go on and on about the conspiracy economy, but if you think about it, you know, the very foundational ideas of the hate movement are conspiracy theories. The idea that white people are under threat, that they are the real targets of racism, that there's a white genocide happening, those are all conspiracy theories. And so Red Ice really started to promote those ideas and bring people on who promoted those ideas. And it's quite a hub, frankly, for the hate movement as we know it today. And Lana speaks regularly at white nationalist events, conferences, things like that. And she has a pretty large following online. So it's interesting because, you know, to go back to this question of why do people radicalize and what is it that they're looking for, I think she's a good example of someone who, yes, is looking for purpose, is looking for narrative, is looking for, you know, all of those things, community. But in this case, she's also making money off of it. You mentioned the women of the KKK earlier, and I know that maybe it was Linda Gordon who you were speaking to,
yes.
The historian, and she has talked about how at the zenith of the KKK in the 20s, one of the reasons that people got involved is because they saw a way for it to be profitable to them. And economics are never, fully disaggregated from this space. And so I think Lana is a very good reminder of that.
So just as we see the women in the Trump administration claiming that their very presence is proof that Trump is not a sexist, do you see the white women in the white nationalist movement also making similar claims that their presence serves as a way to, undermine some of the criticism that the movement gets?
Absolutely. That's something they will... That's kind of their first line when somebody suggests that the hate movement is sexist or misogynist, which, to be clear, it is. And we've seen women who are involved in sexist and misogynistic movements over time, sometimes who've led them. I mean, Phyllis Schlafly being the best example of that, probably. A deep, incredibly powerful anti-feminist movement that, frankly, shifted politics in the 70s here in the United States. And so there's a long history of women being involved in anti-feminist spaces and movements. And in this case, they are very quick to say, well, if it was sexist, why would I be here? If they were mean to women, why would I be here? And I think that, frankly, that has been one reason that over the last couple of years, especially, the media has been hesitant to talk about women in the movement. I think that there's this assumption that women wouldn't actually be involved in something that's sexist and misogynistic. And so we struggle, I think, to hold in our minds the possibility that these women might actually be the victims of sexism and misogyny, but they are also the perpetrators of another kind of harm, or in some cases, that exact kind of harm, that they can be both, basically. And so they definitely serve that function of saying, this is not a sexist environment.
Well, finally, what did you conclude about how white nationalism and women's role in it can unravel? I mean, the future of this country depends on defeating white nationalism. We have been here before. We have gone down this horrific path. It has nearly destroyed the nation. We've come out of it, but never fully, and we're back in it again. And so from your study of women in the white nationalist movement, what do you think is the opening for those among us who are feminist and who are anti-racist, who want justice for all people and equality?
Absolutely. I really think that the first step, and this is something I thought a lot about as a white woman working on this project, is not being so quick to say these people have nothing to do with the world as I see it, that they are over there, they're so weird, they've made these bad choices, I have nothing to do with them. And I think women especially, and progressive women, have a responsibility to recognize the ways in which they are complicit in similar systems. One thing I've been thinking about a lot with regard to Black Lives Matter this summer and the language and sort of, promises surrounding that is that it's one thing to say, we would like the police to stop shooting innocent people, often in their homes. It's another thing to say, I would like to see a radical restructuring of how opportunity is distributed in this country, as it pertains to education, as it pertains to housing, as it pertains to any number of things that, are just part of the fabric of daily life. And I think that progressive women especially have a responsibility to recognize how to, disengage from forces that are inherently unjust, and that actually are the same forces that these women on the far right really feed on. So I think that's, sort of looking in the mirror, being willing to say, well, what are the ways that maybe I'm not so different, or that I could be more different? And so I think that that is extraordinarily important, and that women play a vital role in that. And I think the other important role that women can play is calling a spade a spade. So women in white nationalism can infiltrate spaces that men don't do so easily. So, you know, again, mothering groups or, you know, PTAs or, you know, local farm co-ops or any number of things where, you know, they say, oh, you're worried about the health of your family. You're worried about the safety of your family. Like, me too. Have you ever thought about it from this perspective? And I think that progressive women have a really important role to play to say no, to really call something what it is, even if, you know, it's euphemistic. And even if calling that out is uncomfortable, I think that that is incredibly important. I realize that that's not exactly a silver bullet for, you know, the moment in which we find ourselves and for a truly just future. And I think that there are so many other steps that are required by, you know, the government, if we have a new one soon, by, you know, tech companies, by any number of entities. And I think that women especially have this like grassroots responsibility, sort of person to person, neighbor to neighbor, woman to woman. And, you know, this is really the moment to act on that.
Well, Sayward, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Give out the website for where people can find out about your work, maybe the Atavist magazine.
Yes. Well, I would love for people to read the Atavist, but the Atavist is totally separate from my book. The Atavist is magazine.atavist, atavist.com. And we publish one fantastic long form narrative story every month. So I hope people will like that. And then my personal website is saywarddarby.com. And that's where I've been keeping all of my writing and coverage of the book. And you can also find details about how to order the book there.
We'll post links to both of those on our website. Sayward is spelled SEYWARDDARBY.com. Thank you so much and good luck to you.
Thank you so much.
My guest has been Sayward Darby, editor-in-chief of The Atavist magazine. She previously served as the deputy editor of foreign policy and the online editor and assistant managing editor of The New Republic. She's written for The Atlantic, Washington Post, Elle, and others. We've been talking about her new book, Sisters in Heat, American Women on the Front Lines of White Nationalism. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.